On it I shall argue that there is nothing that cannot be understood, that there is nothing that cannot be explained, and that everything is extraordinarily simple. A great deal of the universe does not need any explanation. Elephants, for instance. Once molecules have learnt to compete and to create other molecules in their own image, elephants, and things resembling elephants, will in due course be found roaming through the countryside.
Atkins assumes the evolution of complex things, the subject matter of this book, to be inevitable once the appropriate physical conditions have been set up. He asks what the minimum necessary physical conditions are. What is the minimum amount of design work that a very lazy creator would have to do in order to see to it that the universe, and later elephants and other complex things, would one day come into existence? The answer, from his point of view as a physical scientist, is that the creator could be infinitely lazy. The fundamental original units that we need to postulate in order to understand the coming into existence of everything either consist of literally nothing, according to some physicists, or, according to other physicists, they are units of the utmost simplicity, far too simple to need anything so grand as deliberate creation. Atkins says that elephants and complex things do not need any explanation. But that is because he is a physical scientist who takes for granted the biologist's theory of evolution. He doesn't really mean that elephants don't need an explanation, rather that he is satisfied that biologists can explain elephants, provided they are allowed to take certain facts of physics for granted. His task, as a physical scientist, therefore, is to justify our taking those facts for granted. This he succeeds in doing. My position is complementary. I am a biologist. I take the facts of physics, the facts of the world of simplicity, for granted. If physicists still don't agree over whether those simple facts are yet understood, that is not my problem. My task is to explain elephants and the world of complex things in terms of the simple things that physicists either understand or are working on. The physicist's problem is the problem of ultimate origins and ultimate natural laws. The biologist's problem is the problem of complexity. The biologist tries to explain the workings and the coming into existence of complex things in terms of simpler things. He can regard his task as done when he has arrived at entities so simple that they can safely be handed over to physicists. I am aware that my characterization of a complex object, statistically improbable in a direction that is specified not with hindsight, may seem idiosyncratic. So too may seem my characterization of physics as the study of simplicity. If you prefer some other way of defining complexity, I don't care, and I would be happy to go along with your definition for the sake of discussion. But what I do care about is that whatever we choose to call the quality of being statistically improbable in a direction specified without hindsight, it is an important quality that needs a special effort of explanation. It is the quality that characterizes biological objects as opposed to the objects of physics. The kind of explanation we come up with must not contradict the laws of physics. Indeed, it will make use of the laws of physics, and nothing more than the laws of physics. But it will deploy the laws of physics in a special way that is not ordinarily discussed in physics textbooks. That special way is Darwin's way. I shall introduce its fundamental essence in Chapter 3 under the title of Cumulative Selection. Meanwhile, I want to follow Paley in emphasizing the magnitude of the problem that our explanation faces, the sheer hugeness of biological complexity and the beauty and elegance of biological design. Chapter 2 is an extended discussion of a particular example, radar in bats, discovered long after Paley's time. And here, to end this chapter, let's discuss the eye. Examination of its structure reveals it as an optical instrument with an obvious resemblance to a camera.
The iris diaphragm, which surrounds the outside of the lens, is responsible for constantly varying the aperture, the f-stop. The lens, which is really only part of a compound lens system, is responsible for the variable part of the focusing. Focus is changed by squeezing the lens with muscles, or in chameleons by moving the lens forwards or backwards, as in a man-made camera. The image falls on the retina at the back, where it excites photocells. The light-sensitive cells, photocells, are not the first thing the light hits. They are buried inside and facing away from the light. This odd feature is mentioned again later. The first thing the light hits is, in fact, a layer of ganglion cells, which constitute the electronic interface between the photocells and the brain. Actually, the ganglion cells are responsible for pre-processing the information in sophisticated ways before relaying it to the brain, and in some ways the word interface doesn't do justice to this. Satellite computer might be a fairer name. Wires from the ganglion cells run along the surface of the retina to the blind spot, where they dive through the retina to form the main trunk cable to the brain, the optic nerve. There are about 3 million ganglion cells in the electronic interface, gathering data from about 125 million photocells, or rods. Bear in mind that the complex architecture of each rod is repeated 125 million times in each retina. And comparable complexity is repeated trillions of times elsewhere in the body as a whole. The figure of 125 million photocells is about 5,000 times the number of separately resolvable points in a good quality magazine photograph. The actual light-gathering structures are folded membranes at one end of the rod. Their layered form increases the photocell's efficiency in capturing photons, the fundamental particles of which light is made. If a photon is not caught by the first membrane, it may be caught by the second, and so on. As a result of this, some eyes are capable of detecting a single photon. The middle section of the cell contains lozenge-shaped objects, mostly mitochondria. Mitochondria are found not just in photocells, but in most other cells. Each one can be thought of as a chemical factory which, in the course of delivering its primary product of usable energy, processes more than 700 different chemical substances in long, interweaving assembly lines strung out along the surface of its intricately folded internal membranes. At the end of each photocell, nearest the light, there is a round globule, the nucleus. Again, this is characteristic of all animal and plant cells. Each nucleus, as we shall see in Chapter 5, contains a digitally coded database larger in information content than all 30 volumes of the Encyclopaedia Britannica put together. And this figure is for each cell, not all the cells of a body put together. The total number of cells in the body of a human is about 10 trillion. When you eat a steak, you are shredding the equivalent of more than 100 billion copies of the Encyclopaedia Britannica.
Chapter 2. Good Design. Natural selection is the blind watchmaker. Blind because it does not see ahead, does not plan consequences, has no purpose in view. Yet the living results of natural selection overwhelmingly impress us with the appearance of design, as if by a master watchmaker, impress us with the illusion of design and planning. The purpose of this book is to resolve this paradox to the satisfaction of the reader, and the purpose of this chapter is further to impress the reader with the power of the illusion of design. We shall look at a particular example, and shall conclude that when it comes to complexity and beauty of design, Paley hardly even began to state the case. We may say that a living body or organ is well designed if it has attributes that an intelligent and knowledgeable engineer might have built into it in order to achieve some sensible purpose such as flying, swimming, seeing, eating, reproducing, or more generally promoting the survival and replication of the organism's genes. It is not necessary to suppose that the design of a body or organ is the best that an engineer could conceive of. Often the best that one engineer can do is in any case exceeded by the best that another engineer can do, especially another who lives later in the history of technology. But any engineer can recognize an object that has been designed, even poorly designed, for a purpose, and he can usually work out what that purpose is just by looking at the structure of the object. In Chapter 1, we bothered ourselves mostly with philosophical aspects. In this chapter, I shall develop a particular factual example that I believe would impress any engineer, namely sonar, radar, in bats. In explaining each point, I shall begin by posing a problem that the living machine faces. Then I shall consider possible solutions to the problem that a sensible engineer might consider. I shall finally come to the solution that nature has actually adopted. This one example is, of course, just for illustration. If an engineer is impressed by bats, he'll be impressed by countless other examples of living design.
Bats have a problem. How to find their way around in the dark. They hunt at night and cannot use light to help them find prey and avoid obstacles. You might say that if this is a problem, it's a problem of their own making, a problem that they could avoid simply by changing their habits and hunting by day. But the daytime economy is already heavily exploited by other creatures, such as birds. Given that there is a living to be made at night, and given that alternative daytime trades are thoroughly occupied, natural selection has favoured bats that make a go of the night hunting trade. It is probable, by the way, that the nocturnal trades go way back in the ancestry of all us mammals. In the time when the dinosaurs dominated the daytime economy, our mammalian ancestors probably only managed to survive at all because they found ways of scraping a living at night. Only after the mysterious mass extinction of the dinosaurs about 65 million years ago were our ancestors able to emerge into the daylight in any substantial numbers. Returning to bats, they have an engineering problem. How to find their way and find their prey in the absence of light. Bats are not the only creatures to face this difficulty today. Obviously, the night-flying insects that they prey on must find their way about somehow. Deep-sea fish and whales have little or no light by day or by night because the sun's rays cannot penetrate far below the surface. Fish and dolphins that live in extremely muddy water cannot see because although there is light, it is obstructed and scattered by the dirt in the water. Plenty of other modern animals make their living in conditions where seeing is difficult or impossible. Given the question of how to manoeuvre in the dark, what solutions might an engineer consider? The first one that might occur to him is to manufacture light, to use a lantern or a searchlight. Fireflies and some fish, usually with the help of bacteria, have the power to manufacture their own light, but the process seems to consume a large amount of energy. Fireflies use their light for attracting mates. This doesn't require prohibitively much energy. A male's tiny pinprick can be seen by a female from some distance on a dark night, since her eyes are exposed directly to the light source itself. Using light to find one's way around requires vastly more energy, since the eyes have to detect the tiny fraction of the light that bounces off each part of the scene. The light source must therefore be immensely brighter if it is to be used as a headlight to illuminate the path than if it is to be used as a signal to others. Anyway, whether or not the reason is the energy expense, it seems to be the case that, with the possible exception of some weird deep-sea fish, no animal, apart from man, uses manufactured light to find its way about.
What else might the engineer think of? Well, blind humans sometimes seem to have an uncanny sense of obstacles in their path. It has been given the name facial vision because blind people have reported that it feels a bit like the sense of touch on the face. One report tells of a totally blind boy who could ride his tricycle at a good speed round the block near his home using facial vision. Experiments showed that, in fact, facial vision is nothing to do with touch or the front of the face, although the sensation may be referred to the front of the face, like the referred pain in a phantom severed limb. The sensation of facial vision, it turns out, really goes in through the ears. The blind people, without even being aware of the fact, are actually using echoes of their own footsteps and other sounds to sense the presence of obstacles. Before this was discovered, engineers had already built instruments to exploit the principle, for example, to measure the depth of the sea under a ship. After this technique had been invented, it was only a matter of time before weapons designers adapted it for the detection of submarines. Both sides in the Second World War relied heavily on these devices under such code names as ASDIC, British, and SONAR, American, as well as the similar technology of radar, American, or RDF, British, which uses radio echoes rather than sound echoes. The sonar and radar pioneers didn't know it then, but all the world now knows that bats, or rather natural selection working on bats, had perfected the system tens of millions of years earlier, and their radar achieves feats of detection and navigation that would strike an engineer dumb with admiration. It is technically incorrect to talk about bat radar since they do not use radio waves. It is sonar. But the underlying mathematical theories of radar and sonar are very similar, and much of our scientific understanding of the details of what bats are doing has come from applying radar theory to them. The American zoologist Donald Griffin, who was largely responsible for the discovery of sonar in bats, coined the term echolocation to cover both sonar and radar, whether used by animals or by human instruments. In practice, the word seems to be used mostly to refer to animal sonar.
It is misleading to speak of bats as though they were all the same. It's as though we were to speak of dogs, lions, weasels, bears, hyenas, pandas, and otters all in one breath, just because they are all carnivores. Different groups of bats use sonar in radically different ways, and they seem to have invented it separately and independently, just as the British, Germans, and Americans all independently developed radar. Not all bats use echolocation. The old world tropical fruit bats have good vision, and most of them use only their eyes for finding their way around. One or two species of fruit bats, however, for instance Rosettus, are capable of finding their way around in total darkness where eyes, however good, must be powerless. They are using sonar, but it's a cruder kind of sonar than is used by the smaller bats, with which we in temperate regions are familiar. Rosettus clicks its tongue loudly and rhythmically as it flies, and navigates by measuring the time interval between each click and its echo. A good proportion of Rosettus's clicks are clearly audible to us, which by definition makes them sound rather than ultrasound. Ultrasound is just sound, except that it's too high for humans to hear.
In theory, the higher the pitch of a sound, the better it is for accurate sonar. This is because low-pitch sounds have long wavelengths, which cannot resolve the difference between closely spaced objects. All other things being equal, therefore, a missile that used echoes for its guidance system would ideally produce very high-pitch sounds. Most bats do indeed use extremely high-pitch sounds, far too high for humans to hear, ultrasound. Unlike Rosettus, which can see very well and which uses unmodified, relatively low-pitched sounds to do a modest amount of echolocation to supplement its good vision, the smaller bats appear to be technically highly advanced echo machines. They have tiny eyes which in most cases probably can't see much. They live in a world of echoes, and probably their brains can use echoes to do something akin to seeing images, although it is next to impossible for us to visualize what those images might be like. The noises that they produce are not just slightly too high for humans to hear, like a kind of super dog whistle. In many cases, they are vastly higher than the highest note anybody has heard or can imagine. It is fortunate that we can't hear them, incidentally, for they are immensely powerful and would be deafeningly loud if we could hear them, and impossible to sleep through. These bats are like miniature spy planes, bristling with sophisticated instrumentation. Their brains are delicately tuned packages of miniaturized electronic wizardry, programmed with the elaborate software necessary to decode a world of echoes in real time. Their faces are often distorted into gargoyle shapes that appear hideous to us until we see them for what they are, exquisitely fashioned instruments for beaming ultrasound in desired directions. Although we can't hear the ultrasound pulses of these bats directly, we can get some idea of what is going on by means of a translating machine or bat detector. This receives the pulses through a special ultrasonic microphone and turns each pulse into an audible click or tone which we can hear through headphones. If we take such a bat detector out to a clearing where a bat is feeding, we shall hear when each bat pulse is emitted, although we cannot hear what the pulses really sound like. If our bat is Myotis, one of the common little brown bats, we shall hear a chuntering of clicks at a rate of about 10 per second as the bat cruises about on a routine mission. This is about the rate of a standard teleprinter or a Bren machine gun.
Presumably, the bat's image of the world in which it is cruising is being updated 10 times per second. Our own visual image appears to be continuously updated as long as our eyes are open. We can see what it might be like to have an intermittently updated world image by using a stroboscope at night. This is sometimes done at discotheques, and it produces some dramatic effects. A dancing person appears as a succession of frozen statuesque attitudes. Obviously, the faster we set the strobe, the more the image corresponds to normal, continuous vision. Stroboscopic vision sampling, at the bat's cruising rate of about 10 samples per second, would be nearly as good as normal, continuous vision for some ordinary purposes, though not for catching a ball or an insect. This is just the sampling rate of a bat on a routine cruising flight. When a little brown bat detects an insect and starts to move in on an interception course, its click rate goes up. Faster than a machine gun, it can reach peak rates of 200 pulses per second as the bat finally closes in on the moving target. To mimic this, we should have to speed up our stroboscope so that its flashes came twice as fast as the cycles of mains electricity, which are not noticed in a fluorescent strip light. Obviously, we have no trouble in performing all our normal visual functions, even playing squash or ping pong, in a visual world pulsed at such a high frequency. If we may imagine bat brains as building up an image of the world analogous to our visual images, the pulse rate alone seems to suggest that the bat's echo image might be at least as detailed and continuous as our visual image. Of course, there may be other reasons why it is not so detailed as our visual image. If bats are capable of boosting their sampling rates to 200 pulses per second, why don't they keep this up all the time? Since they evidently have a rate control knob on their stroboscope, why don't they turn it permanently to maximum, thereby keeping their perception of the world at its most acute all the time to meet any emergency?
One reason is that these high rates are suitable only for near targets. If a pulse follows too hard on the heels of its predecessor, it gets mixed up with the echo of its predecessor returning from a distant target. Even if this weren't so, there would probably be good economic reasons for not keeping up the maximum pulse rate all the time. It must be costly producing loud ultrasonic pulses, costly in energy, costly in wear and tear on voice and ears, perhaps costly in computer time. A brain that is processing 200 distinct echoes per second might not find surplus capacity for thinking about anything else. Even the ticking over rate of about 10 pulses per second is probably quite costly, but much less so than the maximum rate of 200 per second. An individual bat that boosted its tick over rate would pay an additional price in energy, etc., which would not be justified by the increased sonar acuity. When the only moving object in the immediate vicinity is the bat itself, the apparent world is sufficiently similar in successive tenths of seconds that it need not be sampled more frequently than this. When the salient vicinity includes another moving object, particularly a flying insect, twisting and turning and diving in a desperate attempt to shake off its pursuer, the extra benefit to the bat of increasing its sample rate more than justifies the increased cost. Of course, the considerations of cost and benefit in this paragraph are all surmise, but something like this almost certainly must be going on. The engineer who sets about designing an efficient sonar or radar device soon comes up against a problem resulting from the need to make the pulses extremely loud. They have to be loud because when a sound is broadcast, its wavefront advances as an ever-expanding sphere. The intensity of the sound is distributed, and in a sense diluted, over the whole surface of the sphere. The surface area of any sphere is proportional to the radius squared. The intensity of the sound at any particular point on the sphere therefore decreases not in proportion to the distance, the radius, but in proportion to the square of the distance from the sound source, as the wavefront advances and the sphere swells. This means that the sound gets quieter pretty fast as it travels away from its source, in this case the bat. When this diluted sound hits an object, say a fly, it bounces off the fly. This reflected sound now, in its turn, radiates away from the fly in an expanding spherical wavefront. For the same reason as in the case of the original sound, it decays as the square of the distance from the fly. By the time the echo reaches the bat again, the decay in its intensity is proportional not to the distance of the fly from the bat, not even to the square of that distance, but to something more like the square of the square, the fourth power of the distance. This means that it is very, very quiet indeed. The problem can be partially overcome if the bat beams the sound by means of the equivalent of a megaphone, but only if it already knows the direction of the target. In any case, if the bat is to receive any reasonable echo at all from a distant target, the outgoing squeak as it leaves the bat must be very loud indeed, and the instrument that detects the echo, the ear, must be highly sensitive to very quiet sounds, the echoes. Bat cries, as we have seen, are indeed often very loud, and their ears are very sensitive.
Now here is the problem that would strike the engineer trying to design a bat-like machine. If the microphone, or ear, is as sensitive as all that, it is in grave danger of being seriously damaged by its own enormously loud outgoing pulse of sound. It's no good trying to combat the problem by making the sounds quieter, for then the echoes would be too quiet to hear. And it is no good trying to combat that by making the microphone, ear, more sensitive, since this would only make it more vulnerable to being damaged by the, albeit now slightly quieter, outgoing sounds. It's a dilemma inherent in the dramatic difference in intensity between outgoing sound and returning echo, a difference that is inexorably imposed by the laws of physics. What other solution might occur to the engineer? When an analogous problem struck the designers of radar in the Second World War, they hit upon a solution which they called send-receive radar. The radar signals were sent out in necessarily very powerful pulses, which might have damaged the highly sensitive aerials, American antennas, waiting for the faint returning echoes. The send-receive circuit temporarily disconnected the receiving aerial just before the outgoing pulse was about to be emitted, then switched the aerial on again in time to receive the echo.
Bats developed send-receive switching technology long, long ago, probably millions of years before our ancestors came down from the trees. It works as follows. In bat ears, as in ours, sound is transmitted from the eardrum to the microphonic sound-sensitive cells by means of a bridge of three tiny bones known, in Latin, as the hammer, the anvil, and the stirrup, because of their shape. The mounting and hinging of these three bones, by the way, is exactly as a hi-fi engineer might have designed it, to serve a necessary impedance-matching function, but that is another story. What matters here is that some bats have well-developed muscles attached to the stirrup and to the hammer. When these muscles are contracted, the bones don't transmit sound so efficiently. It is as though you muted a microphone by jamming your thumb against the vibrating diaphragm. The bat is able to use these muscles to switch its ears off temporarily. The muscles contract immediately before the bat emits each outgoing pulse, thereby switching the ears off so that they are not damaged by the loud pulse. Then they relax so that the ear returns to sensitivity just in time for the returning echo. This send-receive switching system works only if split-second accuracy and timing is maintained. The bat called Tadarida is capable of alternately contracting and relaxing its switching muscles 50 times per second, keeping in perfect synchrony with the machine gun-like pulses of ultrasound. It is a formidable feat of timing, comparable to a clever trick that was used in some fighter planes during the First World War. Their machine guns fired through the propeller, the timing being carefully synchronized with the rotation of the propeller so that the bullets always passed between the blades and never shot them off.
The next problem that might occur to our engineer is the following. If the sonar device is measuring the distance of targets by measuring the duration of silence between the emission of a sound and its returning echo, the method which Rousettus indeed seems to be using, the sounds would seem to have to be very brief staccato pulses. A long drawn-out sound would still be going on when the echo returned, and even if partially muffled by send-receive muscles, would get in the way of detecting the echo. Ideally, it would seem, bat pulses should be very brief indeed. But the briefer a sound is, the more difficult it is to make it energetic enough to produce a decent echo. We seem to have another unfortunate trade-off imposed by the laws of physics. Two solutions might occur to ingenious engineers, indeed did occur to them, when they encountered the same problem, again in the analogous case of radar. Which of the two solutions is preferable depends on whether it is more important to measure range, how far away an object is from the instrument, or velocity, how fast the object is moving relative to the instrument.
The first solution is that known to radar engineers as chirp radar. We can think of radar signals as a series of pulses, but each pulse has a so-called carrier frequency. This is analogous to the pitch of a pulse of sound or ultrasound. Bat cries, as we have seen, have a pulse repetition rate in the tens or hundreds per second. Each one of those pulses has a carrier frequency of tens of thousands to hundreds of thousands of cycles per second. Each pulse, in other words, is a high-pitched shriek. Similarly, each pulse of radar is a shriek of radio waves with a high carrier frequency. The special feature of chirp radar is that it does not have a fixed carrier frequency during each shriek. Rather, the carrier frequency swoops up or down about an octave. If you think of its sound equivalent, each radar emission can be thought of as a swooping wolf whistle. The advantage of chirp radar, as opposed to the fixed pitch pulse, is the following. It doesn't matter if the original chirp is still going on when the echo returns. They won't be confused with each other. This is because the echo being detected at any given moment will be a reflection of an earlier part of the chirp, and will therefore have a different pitch.
Human radar designers have made good use of this ingenious technique. Is there any evidence that bats have discovered it too, just as they did the send-receive system? Well, as a matter of fact, numerous species of bats do produce cries that sweep down, usually through about an octave, during each cry. These wolf whistle cries are known as frequency modulated, FM. They appear to be just what would be required to exploit the chirp radar technique. However, the evidence so far suggests that bats are using the technique not to distinguish an echo from the original sound that produced it, but for the more subtle task of distinguishing echoes from other echoes. A bat lives in a world of echoes from near objects, distant objects, and objects at all intermediate distances. It has to sort these echoes out from each other. If it gives downward swooping wolf whistle chirps, the sorting is neatly done by pitch. When an echo from a distant object finally arrives back at the bat, it will be an older echo than an echo that is simultaneously arriving back from a near object. It will therefore be of higher pitch. When the bat is faced with clashing echoes from several objects, it can apply the rule of thumb, higher pitch means farther away.
The second clever idea that might occur to the engineer, especially one interested in measuring the speed of a moving target, is to exploit what physicists call the Doppler shift. This may be called the ambulance effect, because its most familiar manifestation is the sudden drop in pitch of an ambulance's siren as it speeds past the listener. The Doppler shift occurs whenever a source of sound, or light, or any other kind of wave, and a receiver of that sound move relative to one another. It is easiest to think of the sound source as motionless and the listener as moving. Assume that the siren on a factory roof is wailing continuously, all on one note. The sound is broadcast outwards as a series of waves. The waves can't be seen because they're waves of air pressure. If they could be seen, they would resemble the concentric circles spreading outwards when we throw pebbles into the middle of a still pond. Imagine that a series of pebbles is being dropped in quick succession into the middle of a pond so that waves are continuously radiating out from the middle. If we moor a tiny toy boat at some fixed point in the pond, the boat will bob up and down rhythmically as the waves pass under it. The frequency with which the boat bobs is analogous to the pitch of a sound. Now suppose that the boat, instead of being moored, is steaming across the pond in the general direction of the center from which the wave circles are originating. It will still bob up and down as it hits the successive wave fronts, but now the frequency with which it hits waves will be higher, since it is traveling towards the source of the waves. It will bob up and down at a higher rate. On the other hand, when it has passed the source of the waves and is traveling away the other side, the frequency with which it bobs up and down will obviously go down.
For the same reason, if we ride fast on a preferably quiet motorbike past a wailing factory siren, when we are approaching the factory, the pitch will be raised. Our ears are, in effect, gobbling up the waves at a faster rate than they would if we just sat still. By the same kind of argument, when our motorbike has passed the factory and is moving away from it, the pitch will be lowered. If we stop moving, we shall hear the pitch of the siren as it actually is, intermediate between the two Doppler-shifted pitches. It follows that if we know the exact pitch of the siren, it is theoretically possible to work out how fast we are moving towards or away from it simply by listening to the apparent pitch and comparing it with the known true pitch. The same principle works when the sound source is moving and the listener is still. That is why it works for ambulances. It is rather implausibly said that Christian Doppler himself demonstrated his effect by hiring a brass band to play on an open railway truck as it rushed past his amazed audience. It is relative motion that matters, and as far as the Doppler effect is concerned, it doesn't matter whether we consider the sound source to be moving past the ear or the ear moving past the sound source. If two trains pass in opposite directions, each travelling at 125 miles per hour, a passenger in one train will hear the whistle of the other train swoop down through a particularly dramatic Doppler shift, since the relative velocity is 250 miles per hour. The Doppler effect is used in police radar speed traps for motorists. A static instrument beams radar signals down a road. The radar waves bounce back off the cars that approach and are registered by the receiving apparatus. The faster a car is moving, the higher is the Doppler shift in frequency. By comparing the outgoing frequency with the frequency of the returning echo, the police, or rather their automatic instrument, can calculate the speed of each car. If the police can exploit the technique for measuring the speed of roadhogs, dare we hope to find that bats use it for measuring the speed of insect prey?
The answer is yes. The small bats known as horseshoe bats have long been known to emit long, fixed-pitch hoots rather than staccato clicks or descending wolf whistles. When I say long, I mean long by bat standards. The hoots are still less than a tenth of a second long. And there is often a wolf whistle tacked on to the end of each hoot, as we shall see. Imagine first a horseshoe bat giving out a continuous hum of ultrasound as it flies fast towards a still object like a tree. The wave fronts will hit the tree at an accelerated rate because of the movement of the bat towards the tree. If a microphone were concealed in the tree, it would hear the sound Doppler shifted upwards in pitch because of the movement of the bat. There isn't a microphone in the tree, but the echo reflected back from the tree will be Doppler shifted upwards in pitch in this way. Now, as the echo wave fronts stream back from the tree towards the approaching bat, the bat is still moving fast towards them. Therefore, there is a further Doppler shift upwards in the bat's perception of the pitch of the echo. The movement of the bat leads to a kind of double Doppler shift, whose magnitude is a precise indication of the velocity of the bat relative to the tree. By comparing the pitch of its cry with the pitch of the returning echo, therefore, the bat, or rather its onboard computer in the brain, could, in theory, calculate how fast it was moving towards the tree. This wouldn't tell the bat how far away the tree was, but it might still be very useful information nevertheless. If the object reflecting the echoes were not a static tree but a moving insect, the Doppler consequences would be more complicated, but the bat could still calculate the velocity of relative motion between itself and its target, obviously just the kind of information a sophisticated guided missile like a hunting bat needs. Actually, some bats play a trick that is more interesting than simply emitting hoots of constant pitch and measuring the pitch of the returning echoes. They carefully adjust the pitch of the outgoing hoots in such a way as to keep the pitch of the echo constant after it has been Doppler-shifted. As they speed towards a moving insect, the pitch of their cries is constantly changing, continuously hunting for just the pitch needed to keep the returning echoes at a fixed pitch. This ingenious trick keeps the echo at the pitch to which their ears are maximally sensitive, important since the echoes are so faint. They can then obtain the necessary information for their Doppler calculations by monitoring the pitch at which they are obliged to hoot in order to achieve the fixed pitch echo. I don't know whether man-made devices, either sonar or radar, use this subtle trick, but on the principle that most clever ideas in this field seem to have been developed first by bats, I don't mind betting that the answer is yes. It is only to be expected that these two rather different techniques, the Doppler shift technique and the chirp radar technique, would be useful for different special purposes. Some groups of bats specialize in one of them, some in the other. Some groups seem to try to get the best of both worlds, tacking an FM wolf whistle onto the end, or sometimes the beginning, of a long, constant frequency hoot. Another curious trick of horseshoe bats concerns the movements of their outer ear flaps. Unlike other bats, horseshoe bats move their outer ear flaps in fast, alternating forward and backward sweeps. It is conceivable that this additional rapid movement of the listening surface relative to the target causes useful modulations in the Doppler shift, modulations that supply additional information. When the ear is flapping towards the target, the apparent velocity of movement towards the target goes up. When it is flapping away from the target, the reverse happens. The bat's brain knows the direction of flapping of each ear, and in principle could make the necessary calculations to exploit the information.
Possibly the most difficult problem of all that bats face is the danger of inadvertent jamming by the cries of other bats. Human experimenters have found it surprisingly difficult to put bats off their stride by playing loud artificial ultrasound at them. With hindsight, one might have predicted this. Bats must have come to terms with the jamming avoidance problem long ago. Many species of bats roost in enormous aggregations, in caves that must be a deafening babel of ultrasound and echoes, yet the bats can still fly rapidly about the cave, avoiding the walls and each other in total darkness. How does a bat keep track of its own echoes and avoid being misled by the echoes of others? The first solution that might occur to an engineer is some sort of frequency coding. Each bat might have its own private frequency, just like separate radio stations. To some extent, this may happen, but it's by no means the whole story.
How bats avoid being jammed by other bats is not well understood, but an interesting clue comes from experiments on trying to put bats off. It turns out that you can actively deceive some bats if you play back to them their own cries with an artificial delay. Give them, in other words, false echoes of their own cries. It is even possible, by carefully controlling the electronic apparatus delaying the false echo, to make the bats attempt to land on a phantom ledge. I suppose it is the bat equivalent of looking at the world through a lens. It seems that bats may be using something that we would call a strangeness filter. Each successive echo from a bat's own cries produces a picture of the world that makes sense in terms of the previous picture of the world built up with earlier echoes. If the bat's brain hears an echo from another bat's cry and attempts to incorporate it into the picture of the world that it has previously built up, it will make no sense. It will appear as though objects in the world have suddenly jumped in various random directions. Objects in the real world do not behave in such a crazy way, so the brain can safely filter out the apparent echo as background noise. If a human experimenter feeds the bat artificially delayed or accelerated echoes of its own cries, the false echoes will make sense in terms of the world picture that the bat has previously built up. The false echoes are accepted by the strangeness filter because they're plausible in the context of the previous echoes. They cause objects to seem to shift in position by only a small amount, which is what objects plausibly can be expected to do in the real world. The bat's brain relies upon the assumption that the world portrayed by any one echo pulse will be either the same as the world portrayed by previous pulses or only slightly different. The insect being tracked may have moved a little, for instance.
There is a well-known paper by the philosopher Thomas Nagel called What Is It Like to Be a Bat? The paper is not so much about bats as about the philosophical problem of imagining what it is like to be anything that we are not. The reason a bat is a particularly telling example for a philosopher, however, is that the experiences of an echolocating bat are assumed to be peculiarly alien and different from our own. If you want to share a bat's experience, it is almost certainly grossly misleading to go into a cave, shout or bang two spoons together, consciously time the delay before you hear the echo, and calculate from this how far the wall must be. That is no more what it is like to be a bat than the following is a good picture of what it is like to see colour. Use an instrument to measure the wavelength of the light that is entering your eye. If it is long, you are seeing red. If it is short, you're seeing violet or blue. It happens to be a physical fact that the light that we call red has a longer wavelength than the light that we call blue. Different wavelengths switch on the red-sensitive and the blue-sensitive photocells in our retinas. But there's no trace of the concept of wavelength in our subjective sensation of the colours. Nothing about what it is like to see blue or red tells us which light has the longer wavelength. If it matters, it usually doesn't, we just have to remember it or look it up in a book. Similarly, a bat perceives the position of an insect using what we call echoes, but the bat surely no more thinks in terms of delays of echoes when it perceives an insect than we think in terms of wavelengths when we perceive blue or red.
Indeed, if I were forced to try the impossible to imagine what it is like to be a bat, I would guess that echolocating for them might be rather like seeing for us. We are such thoroughly visual animals that we hardly realize what a complicated business seeing is. Objects are out there, and we think that we see them out there. But I suspect that really our percept is an elaborate computer model in the brain, constructed on the basis of information coming from out there, but transformed in the head into a form in which that information can be used. Wavelength differences in the light out there become coded as colour differences in the computer model in the head. Shape and other attributes are encoded in the same kind of way, encoded into a form that is convenient to handle. The sensation of seeing is, for us, very different from the sensation of hearing, but this cannot be directly due to the physical differences between light and sound. Both light and sound are, after all, translated by the respective sense organs into the same kind of nerve impulses. It is impossible to tell from the physical attributes of a nerve impulse whether it is conveying information about light, about sound, or about smell. The reason the sensation of seeing is so different from the sensation of hearing and the sensation of smelling is that the brain finds it convenient to use different kinds of internal model of the visual world, the world of sound, and the world of smell. It is because we internally use our visual information and our sound information in different ways and for different purposes that the sensations of seeing and hearing are so different. It is not directly because of the physical differences between light and sound. But a bat uses its sound information for very much the same kind of purpose as we use our visual information. It uses sound to perceive and continuously update its perception of the position of objects in three-dimensional space, just as we use light. The type of internal computer model that it needs, therefore, is one suitable for the internal representation of the changing positions of objects in three-dimensional space. My point is that the form that an animal's subjective experience takes will be a property of the internal computer model. That model will be designed in evolution for its suitability for useful internal representation, irrespective of the physical stimuli that come to it from outside. Bats and we need the same kind of internal model for representing the position of objects in three-dimensional space. The fact that bats construct their internal model with the aid of echoes, while we construct ours with the aid of light, is irrelevant. That outside information is, in any case, translated into the same kind of nerve impulses on its way to the brain. My conjecture, therefore, is that bats see in much the same way as we do, even though the physical medium by which the world out there is translated into nerve impulses is so different, ultrasound rather than light. Bats may even use the sensations that we call colour for their own purposes, to represent differences in the world out there that have nothing to do with the physics of wavelength, but which play a functional role for the bat, similar to the role that colours play to us. Perhaps male bats have body surfaces that are subtly textured so that the echoes that bounce off them are perceived by females as gorgeously coloured, the sound equivalent of the nuptial plumage of a bird of paradise. I don't mean this just as some vague metaphor. It is possible that the subjective sensation experienced by a female bat when she perceives a male really is, say, bright red, the same sensation as I experience when I see a flamingo. Or at least, the bat's sensation of her mate may be no more different from my visual sensation of a flamingo than my visual sensation of a flamingo is different from a flamingo's visual sensation of a flamingo. Donald Griffin tells a story of what happened when he and his colleague Robert Galambos first reported to an astonished conference of zoologists in 1940 their new discovery of the facts of bat echolocation. One distinguished scientist was so indignantly incredulous that he seized Galambos by the shoulders and shook him, while complaining that we could not possibly mean such an outrageous suggestion. Radar and sonar were still highly classified developments in military technology, and the notion that bats might do anything even remotely analogous to the latest triumphs of electronic engineering struck most people as not only implausible, but emotionally repugnant.
It is easy to sympathize with the distinguished skeptic. There is something very human in his reluctance to believe. And that really says it. Human is precisely what it is. It is precisely because our own human senses are not capable of doing what bats do that we find it hard to believe. Because we can only understand it at a level of artificial instrumentation and mathematical calculations on paper, we find it hard to imagine a little animal doing it in its head. Yet the mathematical calculations that would be necessary to explain the principles of vision are just as complex and difficult, and nobody has ever had any difficulty in believing that little animals can see. The reason for this double standard in our scepticism is, quite simply, that we can see and we can't echolocate.
I can imagine some other world in which a conference of learned and totally blind bat-like creatures is flabbergasted to be told of animals called humans that are actually capable of using the newly discovered inaudible rays called light, still the subject of top-secret military development, for finding their way about. These otherwise humble humans are almost totally deaf. Well, they can hear after a fashion and even utter a few ponderously slow, deep-drawling growls, but they only use these sounds for rudimentary purposes like communicating with each other. They don't seem capable of using them to detect even the most massive objects. They have instead highly specialized organs called eyes for exploiting light rays. The sun is the main source of light rays, and humans, remarkably, manage to exploit the complex echoes that bounce off objects when light rays from the sun hit them. They have an ingenious device called a lens, whose shape appears to be mathematically calculated so that it bends these silent rays in such a way that there is an exact one-to-one mapping between objects in the world and an image on a sheet of cells called the retina. These retinal cells are capable, in some mysterious way, of rendering the light audible, one might say, and they relay their information to the brain. Our mathematicians have shown that it is theoretically possible, by doing the right, highly complex calculations, to navigate safely through the world using these light rays, just as effectively as one can in the ordinary way using ultrasound, in some respects even more effectively. But who would have thought that a humble human could do these calculations? Echo sounding by bats is just one of the thousands of examples that I could have chosen to make the point about good design. Animals give the appearance of having been designed by a theoretically sophisticated and practically ingenious physicist or engineer. But there is no suggestion that the bats themselves know or understand the theory, in the same sense as a physicist understands it.
The bat should be thought of as analogous to the police radar trapping instrument, not to the person who designed that instrument. The designer of the police radar speed meter understood the theory of the Doppler effect and expressed this understanding in mathematical equations explicitly written out on paper. The designer's understanding is embodied in the design of the instrument, but the instrument itself does not understand how it works. The instrument contains electronic components which are wired up so they automatically compare two radar frequencies and convert the result into convenient units, miles per hour. The computation involved is complicated but well within the powers of a small box of modern electronic components wired up in the proper way. Of course, a sophisticated conscious brain did the wiring up, or at least designed the wiring diagram, but no conscious brain is involved in the moment-to-moment working of the box. Our experience of electronic technology prepares us to accept the idea that unconscious machinery can behave as if it understands complex mathematical ideas. This idea is directly transferable to the workings of living machinery. A bat is a machine whose internal electronics are so wired up that its wing muscles cause it to home in on insects as an unconscious guided missile homes in on an aeroplane. So far, our intuition, derived from technology, is correct. But our experience of technology also prepares us to see the mind of a conscious and purposeful designer in the genesis of sophisticated machinery. It is this second intuition that is wrong in the case of living machinery. In the case of living machinery, the designer is unconscious natural selection, the blind watchmaker.
I hope that the reader is as awestruck as I am, and as William Paley would have been, by these bat stories. My aim has been in one respect identical to Paley's aim. I do not want the reader to underestimate the prodigious works of nature and the problems we face in explaining them. Echolocation in bats, although unknown in Paley's time, would have served his purpose just as well as any of his examples. Paley rammed home his argument by multiplying up his examples. He went right through the body from head to toe, showing how every part, every last detail, was like the interior of a beautifully fashioned watch. In many ways, I should like to do the same, for there are wonderful stories to be told, and I love storytelling. But there is really no need to multiply examples. One or two will do. The hypothesis that can explain bat navigation is a good candidate for explaining anything in the world of life. And if Paley's explanation for any one of his examples was wrong, we can't make it right by multiplying up examples. His hypothesis was that living watches were literally designed and built by a master watchmaker. Our modern hypothesis is that the job was done in gradual evolutionary stages by natural selection. Nowadays, theologians are not quite so straightforward as Paley. They don't point to complex living mechanisms and say that they are self-evidently designed by a creator, just like a watch. But there is a tendency to point to them and say, it is impossible to believe that such complexity or such perfection could have evolved by natural selection. Whenever I read such a remark, I always feel like writing, "Speak for yourself," in the margin. There are numerous examples, I counted 35 in one chapter, in the book The Probability of God by the Bishop of Birmingham, Hugh Montefiore. I shall use this book for all my examples in the rest of this chapter because it is a sincere and honest attempt by a reputable and educated writer to bring natural theology up to date. When I say honest, I mean honest. Unlike some of his theological colleagues, Bishop Montefiore is not afraid to state that the question of whether God exists is a definite question of fact. He has no truck with shifty evasions such as, "Christianity is a way of life. The question of God's existence is eliminated. It is a mirage created by the illusions of realism." Parts of his book are about physics and cosmology, and I am not competent to comment on those except to note that he seems to have used genuine physicists as his authorities. Would that he had done the same in the biological parts. Unfortunately, he preferred here to consult the works of Arthur Koestler, Fred Hoyle, Gordon Rattray Taylor, and Karl Popper. The bishop believes in evolution, but cannot believe that natural selection is an adequate explanation for the course